From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. How important is it to maintain a reasonable balance between work and the rest of your life? Most Americans say it's very important, but according to a recent international ranking, they do pretty poorly when it comes to achieving that balance, close to the bottom among other industrialized nations. And there's been a lot of angst lately as to why that's the case. Books with titles like Overwhelmed and whole organizations devoted to helping people create time for life. But now a bit of a backlash has developed to this idea that Americans are busier than ever. While it's clear some are truly struggling to make ends meet, others who are harried may choose to live that way, saying yes to everything and never untethering from technology that ties them to work. Today in The Exchange, work-life worries. What's your take on this topic? How balanced or unbalanced do you feel when it comes to work and the rest of your life? How about the people around you? Who's got this thing figured out and who doesn't? Give us a call. Let us know what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guest for the hour joins us from the D.C. area. We're talking with Bridget Schulte. She's staff writer at The Washington Post, who covers work-life issues and poverty. And she's the author of the book, Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play, When No One Has the Time. Bridget Schulte, it's great to have you. I'm so happy that you can join us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, in your book, Bridget, on your blog, you write a lot about what you call the overwhelm. Now, that's the first time I've heard overwhelmed used as a noun. What's the overwhelm, Bridget?
Well, it's funny. I did decide to turn the adjective into a noun because I just wanted to capture this sort of incredibly overwhelming, to use the word, this feeling that everything was happening all at once, all the time. You're burning your candle on both ends and out the middle. You're always rushing. You're driving off. Your wallet's on top of the car. You're never doing enough. Your to-do list never ends. You lay awake at night thinking of all the stuff you haven't done or haven't done well enough. And at the same time, you have this sort of pervasive sadness almost that you're living life on the sidelines and it's careening past and there's nothing you can do about it.
Wow. So you're living life maybe more fully than you should. On the other hand, you don't feel like you're living life.
Well, yeah, it's just it's almost like the way I describe it is like you're hanging on by your fingernails, you know, and you're just trying not to let go to try to get to the end of the day, that there's just always the feeling that there's always so much to do, that there's so much pressure at work. There's pressure to be the perfect parent, particularly the perfect mom. There's pressure to keep your house in a certain way. There's just so much stuff going on in your life that it's hard to keep track of it all. And then you get so busy, you forget what's really important.
How do you feel it personally? Just give us a typical example from a typical Bridget Schulte day of the overwhelm.
I have to say, if you read chapter one, that's when I was very much caught up in it. And I would like to say that after taking the book's journey, which is really what it was, to really understand, well, why do I feel this way? Why do so many people feel this way? And is there anything you can do about it? Is there a better way? I would like to think that at the end of that journey, it is different. I don't feel as overwhelmed right now. I think that this is an overwhelming time, and I've come to understand a lot better why, and then how to try to navigate it a little bit better. So my life does not feel as overwhelming right now. I take time to really stop and think about what's important, and then try to organize my time, my day, based on that. And if there's a whole lot of stuff at the end of the day that didn't get done on the to-do list, you know what? That's okay.
Oh well, right? I mean, here we are.
Well, you know what? The to-do list is never going to end. There's always going to be more stuff to do. I wrote an excerpt for Time, and I loved the headline that they put on it. They said, I'll do the dishes when I'm dead. That's really true. You know, our lives are short, and sometimes we get so busy, we get so caught up in being busy, sometimes because we choose, sometimes because, it's easier than to think about some of these bigger, harder questions. What does my life mean? What am I really doing? What's important?
So give us an example, if you could then, Bridget, from your earlier life, before you kind of got religion, if I could put it that way.
Well, and I'm trying, you know, I put everything very much in the, you know, it's not like I'm a guru. I haven't figured it all out, but I'm figuring it out. But before, yeah, my kids were young. I worked a very demanding job that was very important to me. It was important to do it well. It was really important to me to be a great mother. I had no role models for how to do it. My role model for how to work was my dad, and he always worked all the time, and he was very serious, so I tried to work like him. And my role model for how to be a mom was my mom, and she was a stay-at-home mom, and her whole life revolved around us, and she was like a chauffeur, and she drove us everywhere, and I had lessons. And so I didn't want my kids to miss out on what I thought would be a great childhood because I worked. I felt very guilty about that. So I was always really struggling to try to really live two lives at one time. And I didn't even realize that even though my husband and I had said we would be equal partners and we were going to, you know, try to have a very different marriage than my parents did, we really very easily fell into those traditional patterns. And without even thinking about it, I was really doing everything. I was doing all the stuff at home. I was doing all the stuff with the kids. And he would, quote unquote, help out. But that didn't free up any mental space at all. So my head was just completely crammed all the time with all sorts of stuff. You know, I love this term that I discovered as I reported the book. Sociologists call it contaminated time, that you've just got so much stuff on your mind that you can't even fully be where you are. And even if you're in a moment that looks like leisure, like riding a bike with your family, or it's very hard to be in that moment because you're constantly thinking, what about the carpool? What about the, oh my goodness, what am I going to have for dinner? And I forgot about this. And what about that? You know, and so you can't really even enjoy where you are.
Well, speaking of what you referred to earlier, you know, wanting to do everything perfectly, there's a great quote from Deborah Spar, president of Barnard. She calls it the triple whammy in her recent book. You have to keep house like Martha Stewart, parent like Donna Reed, work like Sheryl Sandberg, and look like Jennifer Aniston. And she says that's nuts, of course. But where does that come from? We all know it's nuts, but still we kind of hope maybe we could get close.
You know, it's really interesting. And it all goes back to this question of having it all. And what does having it all mean? And it's almost like when we decided 40 years ago that we could shift what men and women could and should do, and that women could have lives in the public sphere, they could work, they could become educated, that their whole life did not have to revolve around being a housewife and a mother, which is really for much of the 19th and 20th century, sort of a very narrowly defined role for women. Once that role expanded, it's almost like we went nuts and we thought, okay, well, you can't just be ordinary. You have to be extraordinary. And so part of what my book is about is, let's really think about what we mean by all, and let's talk about men. Men need to have it all as well. And if they can have it all, which means more caregiving at home, then it makes it a whole lot easier for both people to live really more human lives.
Again, today in The Exchange, we're talking about work-life balance. We'd love your take on this topic. How balanced or unbalanced do you feel when it comes to work and the rest of your own life? What about the people around you? Who among your friends and family do you think really has this figured out, and who absolutely does not? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guest is Bridget Schulte, staff writer at The Washington Post. She covers work-life issues, and her new book is Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Derek Thompson, senior writer at The Atlantic. And he's looked at this in terms of demographics and income levels and so forth. You can join us now with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Here's a Facebook comment from Nick, Bridget, who says, because we have a sort of frenzied, kamikaze work ethic society that says if you're not killing yourself, you're not working hard enough. It does seem sort of quaint to hear people talk about, you know, the 50s and 60s working 9 to 5. People think, wow, who works 9 to 5?
He's absolutely right. And I think that's part of, you know, when you ask about what the overwhelm is, part of it is what we expect at work has gotten so out of proportion for anybody. And part of it is what we expect for parents, particularly of mothers, is higher than it's ever been. We've got these crazy, unrealistic ideals that we think that we need to live up to. And a big part of why is a changing economy. You know, I think it's really important for people to understand that it's not all their fault. fault that we are reacting to some of these larger forces in our lives, that our economy has changed and there's an awful lot of uncertainty. Technology makes us, while it connects us, it makes us all feel like life is speeding up and that there's never enough that you can know and learn and read. You're always feeling behind and that you're missing stuff. And you always feel like you have to be tethered at work. But I think the other thing that's really important to remember is that so many of our laws and our policies in this country are still lined up with a world that doesn't exist anymore. Our tax policies, our Social Security, even our work laws, they all favor families where one person, usually the dad, the man, went to work and one person stayed home and took care of everything else. The kind of proverbial Donna Reed 1950s breadwinner homemaker families. Well, today, maybe one out of every four or five families is that breadwinner homemaker family. Everybody else has all sorts of different combinations. We've got dual earner families. We've got single mothers. We've got single dads. We've got so much diversity in our family structure, and our policies don't support any of that. And that's part of what keeps us all really spinning.
Yeah, I remember a bunch of years back, the principal at one of my kids' schools said, you know, come by once a month for morning coffee with the principal. And, you know, and I thought, okay, I really can't do that, but thank you for the invitation. So things are kind of set up with the expectation that people are around and that they have the time. Where do you think most people fall the most short, Bridget? Is it unrealistic expectations? Is it they can't unhook from technology? Is it they're doing too much at work or too much for their kids? Like if you could pinpoint one area where we're really messing up in terms of work-life balance, what would that be?
Well, I think there's no one area. I think it's a combination of all of these things. And I think, you know, the example you brought up at school is a really good one. A lot of our schools expect, you know, parent-teacher conferences are at 2 in the afternoon. The principal coffee is at 9 in the morning. You know, I dealt with summer camps. I don't know if others out there have dealt with them that run from 10 to 2. You know, those are really very, very difficult times for people who are also trying to work. So even our school structures are very much out of sync with the way we really live our lives.
All right. We will talk more after a short break. We'll take your questions and comments. Nick, thanks for the comment on Facebook. You can comment on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up, Atlantic writer Derek Thompson on why Americans feel busier than ever. He slices and dices the demographics of that question. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, why Americans have so much trouble finding a reasonable work-life balance, even though in surveys they all say it's important to them. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Twitter. Give us your take on this topic. How balanced or unbalanced do you feel when it comes to work and the rest of your own life? With us for the hour is Bridget Schulte, staff writer at The Washington Post and author of the book Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. And joining us now is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, labor markets, and the entertainment business. And Derek Thompson, thanks a lot for making time out for us. We appreciate it.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, and you've looked at this with an eye toward work and leisure, Derek, and slicing and dicing the demographics in a really interesting way. So when you did that, you found some groups have a lot of leisure and others really do not. Before we go there, though, Derek, how do you define leisure?
Right. Leisure is basically the time you don't spend working. Different people define it in different ways. Sometimes it includes sleep. Sometimes it includes caring for a child. But many listeners might understand that caring for a child doesn't always feel like leisure time. So once again, the definition is sometimes one of controversy. But essentially, it's a time that we're spending away from work. And what's interesting is you go back about 100 years, and there was a prediction that John Maynard Keynes made, which was that essentially we would be freed from work because of technology. The technology would replace us in the workplace and give us a lot of leisure time. The interesting thing when you look at what's actually happened in the last 100 years is that a lot of people do work less than they used to. A lot of people who are middle class, a lot of people who are lower class have fewer working hours per year than they used to. But one group that isn't working less is the top 10%, particularly the top 5, top 1%. This is the group which is competitive with elites all around the world. world feels like it always has to be on the clock, tethered to its technology, and is ambitious and wants to move ahead in the world. And so rather than see technology replace work and create this sort of haven of leisure time for Americans, we've really seen something of a schism. We've seen, for the very rich, work becoming more time-consuming, and we've seen, somewhat ironically, for the poor, work becoming less.
And yet you wrote about one group, Derek, single moms. They truly have no work-life balance. Give us a little more there, please.
This is the most important caveat to the sort of two Americas that I described, which is that if you are a single parent in America, there is a good case to make that you might be the most overworked demographic in the developed world. When we
wow.
do time survey studies of single mothers, they appear to be more starved for leisure time than single mothers in any European country, than single mothers in any other developed country. It is truly an exceptional burden to be a single mother in the United States.
So if you're not one of these two groups, Derek, the top 10%, who you say is more harried than ever, probably because they choose to be, they're working to get to the top of their professions or whatever, and single moms who have just a confluence of pressures and are also just incredibly harried and have no work-life balance, why do most people you talk to feel so harried, feel so busy, feel like it never stops?
Right. I think we need to divide the illusion of busyness from the reality of busyness. I think it's very possible that a certain aspect of busyness is an illusion. I think that because we are surrounded by so many different things, abundant entertainment and abundant distractions and diversions for us, that we feel a sense of what some people might call FOMO, a fear of missing out, perma-FOMO, that we're always feeling guilty, that we're not participating in one of the things that we're aware of because we're aware of so much more. So that's an illusion. The reality, however, is that particularly for the group that is working in white-collar jobs with jobs that they can literally take home because they have to answer email all day long, we're talking about work sort of seeping out of the office and into our living rooms. And it's very difficult to disconnect from this feeling like we're always on the clock. And this adds a kind of white noise of busyness in the background that always keeps us sort of stressed that we're not doing everything we can for work and then for our children, you know, for our spouses and so on.
Well, I've heard of FOMA. I remember a trip on to Silicon Valley last year. A lot of people talking about Silicon Valley has a bad case of FOMA, fear of missing out. But you heard it here first, folks. Perma-FOMA, Derek. Permanent fear of missing out. That's great. You know, I want to go to our listeners. Lots of people want to jump in. But first to you, Bridget Schulte, what do you think about this, the illusion of busyness versus the reality of busyness?
No, I think that Derek's absolutely right. When I was working on the book, I went out to North Dakota, of all places, because I thought that maybe busyness was just something that you experienced in these, you know, big cities. I live in Washington, D.C., maybe New York or L.A. So I wanted to go to a more rural area where I thought life would be slower, a little bit more relaxed. And there was actually an academic out there that I went to visit who studies busyness and fast pace of life. And I couldn't believe that she studied that in Fargo, North Dakota. And she said, oh, honey, you want to meet overwhelmed North Dakotans? I can arrange that.
Well, what were they overwhelmed with? Probably the same stuff you are in D.C., right?
Well, and that was the interesting thing. She put together a focus group, and it was fascinating to listen to. You know, from my perspective, their lives wouldn't seem very overwhelming at all. But this woman rushed in late, and she went through this long laundry list of all the stuff she had to do. And then she said, and then I got stuck in traffic. And I looked out the window, and there was one traffic light, and there were three cars, and then cornfields. And it just, I think when Derek talks about the illusion of busyness, that's when it really hit me, that busyness has become such a cultural value for a number of reasons, that we can often create it even when it's really not there, when the traffic is really three cars at the traffic light.
Or we create it. Picking up on that, Bridget, we create it by the choices that we make. You know, yes, I will help you with this project at work. Yes to your child, I will become, you know, a booster for your team and all the fundraising and work that's involved with that. You know, there are choices that we're making that make us truly busy, but they're choices.
That's true. And there are choices that we feel we can't not make. And I think Derek made a really good point about the technology. I think that's something that people feel very, very powerless to do anything about. You feel like you always have to be on. Maybe the boss is going to email you in the evening, or maybe there's some story or something going on and you've got to know about it. And so you check at 8, 9, 10, you sleep with your smartphone. I think there is that kind of busyness that people feel they can't do anything about. And then I think there is the busyness where we're just trying to fit in with our neighbors because that's what we see everybody else doing.
Keeping up with the Joneses in terms of busyness. Let's go to our listeners. A couple Facebook comments I want to share with you, but let's go to a caller first. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Kathleen's waiting in Meredith. Hi, Kathleen. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just called in to, I wanted to weigh in on, I think that sometimes we're driven by the judgment of others. I'm a single parent, and I work 50 to 60 hours a week. And I still get comments from my friends that maybe my house isn't as clean as it should be. And I find this very interesting because I think something has to go, and that's what I've chosen to let go. But I think some of the pressure comes right from the people around me.
Well, how do you, you know, since you're one of the groups that Derek says is just among the most harried in America, how do you maintain it? Do you have any sort of work-life, Kathleen, work-life balance, or are you just kind of hanging on by your fingernails?
I've made a conscious decision to try to keep a divide between my job and home so that I can focus on my daughter and do those things. It also helps that she turned 16 and got her license, so I don't have to drive her everywhere.
Yeah,
that's
a
big help. I don't know that I'm any busier than my friends who are not single parents. I think that all parents who work are pulled in a lot of directions. I think the one thing I don't have is somebody at home to like say, I need help. Can you get the dishes done? Can you whatever? And that's why I said, you know, if last night's dishes are still in the sink in the morning, I'm not going to sweat it.
Right. Talking about the dishes again, something that you mentioned earlier, Bridget. What do you think about this call, Derek? Again, she's from one of those groups that you talked about that is truly harried.
Absolutely. One thing that she mentioned, which is true more broadly speaking, is that in the last few decades, we spend more and more time with our children. American children are really doted after in terms of the hours dedicated by parents, particularly middle and upper class parents. There's only 24 hours in a day, however, and the time has to come out of somewhere, and it's come out of housework women spend significantly less time across all demographics on housework, partly because they have technology that can help them with this, with, you know, washing and drying machines and better cleaning technology and things like that. But generally speaking, this is the caller identified a trend that is actually extremely prevalent. The other point that I wanted to make really briefly is that I do think that Bridget brought up a really interesting point, that there's sort of a busyness that we choose and a busyness that we're inflicted with. Some of us, who are really ambitious and want to get that great job and also want, three kids and also want a perfect house, they are choosing busyness. They are choosing a feeling of overwhelmness. And that, I think, is very different from the kind of busyness required by, say, a single mother of two children who has to work 30, 40, 50 hours a week in order to provide for their upbringing and has to care for them because there's no one else in the house and occasionally has to put away the toys in the living room. And so we do see there's a difference when we talk about busyness between that which we choose to embark on and that which we're sort of put on.
Yeah, well, Kathleen, it's great to hear from you. And here's an email from Ashley Jane. She says, I was medically forced to have a more balanced life. I was never very good at slowing down or valuing fun. Then I became chronically ill and learned that my symptoms, especially pain, can be decreased by rest, downtime, genuine social interaction, hobbies and fun. Wow, Ashley Jane, thank you so much for emailing. And, you know, I wonder, Bridget, if through the course of your work, either your book or your blog, if you've looked at this angle of busyness that, you know, it can make you sick.
Well, absolutely. I have a whole chapter on not only how it can how that stress can make you physically sick, but how it's actually shrinking our brains. It's not good for
us. That's scary.
Yes, that's not good for us on a whole lot of levels. But I think the other thing that's really important, you know, one of the things that Derek brought up, which I was fascinated by, were these predictions that we would be living in this age of leisure by now, that there would we would be so productive, and all this great technology would open up this vast sense of space. And we would have like live these wonderful lives and fill them with art and pleasure and leisure. And that didn't happen for a number of reasons. But one of the things that I find so fascinating is this real devaluation of leisure in our modern era, that we tend to think of it as silly, as a waste of time, that unless we're being productive, that this is not good time. Now, again, you have lots of different kinds of leisure. And I write about it in my book, and Derek talked about it as well, this sort of schism where you've got very busy people at the very top of the socioeconomic ladder, and their leisure tends to be very harried, and you're going from one thing to the next, and it's just sort of one more thing to check off in the box. And for those at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, they've got so much time because they're trying to cobble together all sorts of kind of crummy part-time jobs, and their leisure is just perhaps blank space worried about how to pay the rent. It's not necessarily that they're filling their souls, like the Greeks would say. But I think it's interesting, too, that for women in particular, it's very hard because of the history of leisure. Leisure has typically been available to high-status men throughout human history. Women tend to not feel that they have permission to have leisure. They don't deserve it. They have to earn it. And the only way you earn it is to get to the end of this long to-do list that never comes. I think that it's interesting. We are spending more time with our kids, particularly women. And it's not just that the housework hours have fallen. They indeed have. But if you look at how they're spending their leisure time, they're spending almost every minute with their children. And so that's another way of feeling sort of breathless, if you will, that you've got to devote all of this energy to your kids, and there's really no time for kind of figuring out what it is that you like or what you want or what that, what the caller just talked about, having space for that in your life.
Wow.
It's very difficult.
Well, and leisure, boy, when I hear leisure, I think about, lying on my back looking at the clouds roll by or, sitting reading a book. I don't think about sort of managing my kids or, doing housework as leisure. So it's
right.
Kinda,
it doesn't feel that way.
No, it doesn't feel that way. And it's probably not what Keynes envisioned either. Thank you for that call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. Christopher's in Laconia. Hi, Christopher. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to comment as a business owner that businesses have a role in supporting our employees' desire for a work-life balance. And we found it to be very successful that when you make that part of your corporate culture, our retention has been much stronger, our loyalty has been much stronger, and our results have been excellent for the company as a result. But on the flip side, I'm sitting here smiling as I'm driving because as a business owner, we don't take time off, meaning we have time away from the office, but then you feel very guilty that you're not supporting the business that you're trying to grow. So you end up taking like hours off within a business day, and you count that time as being off when in reality you're not really off. So I think that businesses can support our employees, but yet I don't think we do, as business owners, I don't think we do a very good job of finding that same support ourselves.
Well, it's tough, though, isn't it, Christopher? Because, if you take that time, you think, oh, my goodness, what's happening at the business? And there's all those employees, I don't know how many you have, who depend on you, right? I mean, it's not just you. It's all these other people who are hoping that you can give them a paycheck.
That's right. And there's a guilt factor, the good Puritan guilt factor that's in there that as a business owner, you notify everybody by email that you're going to take, from 10 to 2 off, quote unquote, except if you need me, you can call me or you can email me or, I'll be available.
Small O off, Christopher, I'm guessing, right? Not off,
right.
Off. So what sorts of cultural values do you have at your workplace, given that you feel this way, that you at least extend to your employees, if not yourself?
Yeah, we make it part of our interview process that we believe and support the work-life balance. We have a whole work-life balance survey that we have our employees go through prior to becoming part of the company. And then we make that a cultural expectation that we know that they're going to have things in their life that are important to them and that we're going to support those, whether it's taking time off for a, you know, a parent-teacher conference or going to a soccer game or a vacation during the course of a busy time. We found that if we make those norms and cultural expectations prevalent during the interview process and then support them, people, they really get it, and I think that they approve of that, and it makes them more loyal to the company.
All right. Well, Christopher, great to hear from you. Thank you very much for calling in. And, Derek, final thoughts from you on this whole topic and, you know, maybe how we could rethink the way we look at this work-life balance thing.
First, quickly, I think the caller made a really interesting point, which is that it's somewhat ironic that his employees have chosen to join a company that values work-life balance. But business owners, entrepreneurs, writers like me and Bridget, we have sort of chosen, in a way, the opposite. We've chosen a life in which we always somewhat have to be on call. When you're
right.
a writer, there's always something that you can be writing. When you're a business owner, an entrepreneur, you always have to be by the phone ready to talk to a client or employee. And so I think that it goes back to one of the two points that I made earlier, which is that for a lot of Americans, for better or worse, we are choosing to be busy. We are choosing to be overwhelmed. And just as you can choose to be overwhelmed, if you don't value your work and you don't love it, you should make the other choice and choose leisure. That being said, I think that, you know, you go back to the other caller, the single mom, who is dealing with a situation in which busyness and feeling overwhelmed is going to be an inherent part, or has been, but for
not
a daughter
to
be able to drive inherent, it to her life.
Derek, it's great to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Coming up, speaking of choosing, we'll hear an email from Amy who talks about some of the choices she's made. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, political junkie Ken Rudin returns to the Granite State to talk midterm elections. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today on The Exchange, work-life balance, why so many Americans say they struggle to achieve it. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Bridget Schulte is with us for the hour, staff writer at The Washington Post, author of the book Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. Again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. And Bridget, here's an email from Amy that came in about some of the choices that she and her husband made. After the birth of our second child, my husband and I decided to live off one income so that we could have me around for our children, choosing to have flexibility and time over money. By doing so, we drive older cars and still have an old TV, etc. We don't have the latest of anything, but we have a healthy savings despite all of this, and refuse to live in constant stress and debt to keep up with the normal American standards. My husband recently passed up a name your price work opportunity, but said no because he didn't want to lose control over our destiny. I guess we just feel experiences are more important than things. Could you pick up on that last part? Experiences more important than things. Some people say that Americans work so much because they like to have a lot of stuff.
Well, there is something to that, and I think that that's something that we have to look at. At the same time, you know, when you look at wages particularly and what we earn, there are very few families that are able to, that feel they can make the choices that Amy made. It's so expensive to live. When you look at costs have continued to rise, for instance, the cost of college, college tuition has gone up 1,000% since the 1980s, 1,000%. At the same time, most of our wages have been fairly stagnant since the 1970s. So you've got that disconnect there. So that's part of what keeps people working so hard. And then I think the other thing is it's very true. There's always the latest thing, the newest stuff. You know, the iPhone, when you think about it, the iPhone doesn't ever really change. It's really still a phone, but we have to get the next one and the next one and the next one. You know, so there is this sort of cultural compulsion to get the next newest, biggest, shiniest thing. And you can sort of blame advertising for that. But on the other hand, you can also blame the messages that we get. You know, our economy is powered by 70% of consumer spending. And so all of the reports that come out about how our economy is doing is like, well, are people confident? Are they spending? Are they not? And so you have all of these very mixed messages that you need stuff, that you need to buy stuff to make our economy strong. You know, and I would argue, just like Amy does, that's it's gotten us into this sort of unsustainable spiral that kind of keeps us going and going, getting more stuff and losing out on time and experiences, which, frankly, at the end of your life, what are you going to remember?
Let's take another call. This is Patty in Stratum. Hi, Patty. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Laura and everyone. I run a program for homeless families in Stratum. And one of the things that I hear over and over again is that folks are afraid that they will lose their jobs, and that's why they don't disconnect. And I think that that's very important. I think as a director myself, I think that probably that's one of the reasons that I have a hard time to disconnect. There's so much unemployment right now. You know, college, we just put a son through college. Who knows where he's going to be able to get a job? So I think that, part of the fear and part of feeling overwhelmed is that, will I have a job tomorrow? And it's not so much can I balance everything, is will I have a job and I have to support my family? So I think that's another take on that whole issue.
Well, it's a great point, Patty. And I think you've written about this, Bridget. I know that Derek has as well. You know, everyone else is checking work email. And if I want to stay gainfully employed, I better check work email, you know, at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock.
Well, there's really, I think Patty makes a great point, and that is part of what's fueling the overwhelm, as I call it, is this really great sense of uncertainty, this fear of what the future is going to bring. We're really in a place where we haven't been with globalization, with a knowledge economy rather than a manufacturing economy. We don't kind of know what the new jobs are going to be. The new jobs that are being created may not last. You have all these kind of startups, and then they die off, and how are you going to find, you know, in the past you'd get a stable job and you'd stick with it for 15, 20 years. And you've got young people today, when you look at surveys of millennials, they're expecting maybe 1 to 2 years they'll stay at a place and then move on and then move on. And while that was always very true of people in their 20s, usually by the 30s you settled in. People are not feeling that it's going to settle down. So there is so much uncertainty that does keep us tethered to our jobs. And I was writing about vacations recently because that's the other thing that just blows my mind. Americans, you know, not only do we not have policies for paid parental leave, we do not have policies that have that assure high quality childcare. We do, you know, like other advanced economies. We also don't have any policy to assure that we would get time off, paid time off. We're the only advanced economy, I think, other than maybe Nepal and a couple others that do not have vacation policies or paid time off policies. And yet, what we do get. We'll get maybe 10 to 14 days that we'll take, and not everyone takes them. And when you ask why, it's because they're afraid they'll lose their job. They'll be seen as somehow less than dedicated if they take vacation. And if I could follow up just very briefly on one point that, you know, about the vacation and about leisure, and to go back to what Christopher said about being a small business owner and never feeling like he can be off.
Sure.
And that is certainly a feeling that we all have. I think what we forget, and I think neuroscience is showing this, and I think if I have any hope, it's really, frankly, with neuroscience and what we're learning about how humans work and where creativity comes from, what we're discovering is that it really is only in time off and time away, in leisure, if you will, that we get creative ideas, that moment of inspiration comes. It's not going to come when you're just sitting there, powering it through, trying to sit at your desk or doing whatever it is that you do. And, it, you know, more and more as a knowledge economy, we're only as good as our next idea, our next thought. That's where the new businesses that are the new jobs that are being created. So if you never take that time away, you'll never have perhaps that inspiration that will then become something very cool.
Well, sure. There's that classic image of, you know, Newton lying under the tree and an apple falls on his head and he discovers gravity. I mean, I know that's oversimplified, but there is that idea of unfettered brain time leading to more creativity. I do wonder if in that unfettered leisure time, time off, if people are staring into their phones or watching TV, does that count? Does that still count as like free brain time that neuroscientists would say opens up creativity?
you know,
I know we're going a little far afield from work-life balance, but you know,
actually, we're not. It's all part of the same thing, which is part of why I looked at that in the book. You know, there is evidence that if you're going to read, say, People magazine or watch TV, you know, it turns off parts of your brain, the kind of the thinking parts of your brain. I don't know that that's really where you get your inspiration, but you know, what's really clear is that when you have moments of deliberate practice or focused work, you know, like Newton, he didn't all of a sudden come up with the theory of gravity. He had years and years of that dedicated work.
Right.
And then it was in the off moment that, everything kind of came together. Because what neuroscience is finding is that when you're idle, this part of your brain called the default mode network lights up, and it connects different, it's like an airport hub, and it connects different parts of your brain that don't normally communicate. And so then all of a sudden, a random thought, a memory, a stray idea, you know, maybe a snippet of a song will all come together and connect in a completely fresh way. And that's where inspiration comes. You need to be in that completely idle mode, and not a lot of us allow ourselves to go there anymore.
I see. So neuroscientists want us to have leisure, to have unplugged leisure, to have leisure where we're not worrying about the to-do list.
Well, I don't know that they're arguing for that, but I think they're saying that if you want to be inspired and have a moment of creativity, then yes, that is what you need.
Let's go back to our listeners. And here's a Facebook comment from Dominic, who says, it's probably, it meaning lack of work-life balance, is because people who used to make a good living in New Hampshire 10 years ago are now forced to commute 3 to 4 hours a day, round trip to Massachusetts, because they can no longer find a job in their field of expertise in the state where they reside. Long commutes, for sure, Bridget, putting a crimp on work-life balance.
That's really true. And Americans commute a lot. We live far from where we work. That does create a layer of stress. You know, if you can't walk or bike or get to your job easily, if you don't have childcare that's nearby or kids go to school, if you are spread out and always in your car, that does absolutely create a level of stress and eat up a lot of your time.
Here's an email from Sean in Manchester. He says, I've worked with a lot of people that work 60, 70, 80 plus hour weeks, mostly at tech businesses. Sean says this puts pressure on other employees to do the same. He says, I believe in working smarter, not harder. If you can't get it done in a reasonable 40-hour work week, you're doing something wrong. Poor time, task, priority management. Also, he says, if you're a salary employee, you've cut your own pay by working that long. He says, I've left jobs and relationships with workaholics. Sean, thanks for that email. And back to our callers. Allison's in New London. Hi, Allison. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Hi, Bridget. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to just say that we have found in our family that leisure takes practice, and you just can't go from a very busy life and just turn it off and say, okay, this is our leisure time. So we've learned to do a couple things. One is that we have coffee talk, which we call it coffee talk in the morning on the weekends, and anyone who's around comes in, we all have a cup of coffee and we all talk. And then every evening we have wine time, and it's funny because our kids will come over for wine time and we all just sit around and outside if it's lovely and just have a glass of wine and talk. And it brings us all together, but it also brings us down from that pace. And I think that it also has set up a role model for our children on how to establish time for leisure, which I think is an important factor.
So you set up that role model for them so they don't see you being frenzied and harried, and hopefully they won't be frenzied and harried, or at least they'll understand the importance of not being frenzied.
Right, and also scheduling time to go kayaking and scheduling leisure time so that on a routine basis, so that you have leisure all through your work week, and you know you're going to have it.
Well, Allison, great to hear from you. And let's also hear from Rebecca. She's calling from Piermont. Hi, Rebecca. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
Our family has, I think in general, is very busy. And part of that is because even though we're a middle-income family, we can't make it without two incomes. Yeah, we've got 5 children, 2 are out of the house, and I'm homeschooling the youngest.
Wow.
But I work 60 hours a week, and I'm in college full time at Southern New Hampshire University.
Rebecca, when do you sleep?
Well, I do sleep. I do manage to fit in, like your previous callers, some kayaking. That's downtime for me. But I took on the college because that's the way to later in change the lifestyle by having a higher paying job and not having to work as many hours.
Wow.
So it's a conscious decision to work more hours overall right now between the homeschooling and the job to get to that place where I'm not having to work 60 hours a week.
So you've got five kids, although two are out of the house. You're going to college yourself. You have a job and you're homeschooling a child.
Yes.
Wow. Do you have any work-life balance at all, or is it just kind of forget that for now, maybe 5 years from now?
Well, I try to fit in some kayaking, and when I'm working with the 8-year-old who's the homeschooled child, I try to fit in some stuff that I enjoy, like we do some water painting and things like that, because those are also things that I enjoy that he can enjoy too.
So squeezing in a little bit here and there, that's great. What do you think of this call, Bridget? Wow, every time you feel busy, you hear from somebody else who's got at least 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 more balls in the air than you do.
Well, yeah, I think that there are a lot of pressures out there to make a good living, to do meaningful work, to make sure that you have time with your family, and I think it goes back to some of the structures that we have, and I don't know the reason for homeschooling, but the homeschooling is actually growing exponentially. There's more secular homeschooling. It used to always be a very religious kind of community that would homeschool because they didn't feel that the values that they wanted to impart to their children were being imparted in the public school offerings. But, you know, when you look at the secular homeschooling trend, it does make you wonder, have we lost faith in our institutions and are our institutions not supporting us, you know, in a way that then we take on an additional role, you know, because I can imagine feeling like you have to homeschool your child, whether you have to or want to. You know, while you're going to school, while you're working all those hours, you know, that's just an awful lot to take on.
Yeah, although I love what she said about she still manages to find little slices of time to do what she enjoys as well. You know, maybe she doesn't have an hour to read a book, but she's putting, you know, 15, 20, 30 minutes somewhere to do something that she enjoys as well. So there you have it. And thank you very much for calling in, Rebecca. Just to finish up with you, Bridget, you know, since you put out this book and you've been writing a lot on this topic, you did tell us at the beginning of the hour that your own work-life balance has gotten better. Where are you still a work in progress, Bridget? Where could you still improve?
Well, I think I'm very human, you know, so I still work too much. You know, I'm trying to combine, you know, doing hopefully excellent work for The Washington Post while I try to spread the message of the book, which is very important to me. That's like two full-time jobs. It's really important to spend time with my family. My kids are getting older and, you know, it's not as easy to take the family fun adventure because the 13 and 15, they don't want to be with you anymore.
I understand.
So then how do you find kind of connecting time and how do you get them off all of the screens that, you know, they see you on and, you know, how do you model that and unplug yourself? So there's an awful lot that I'm still working on. But, you know, I loved what one of the callers talked about, coffee time and wine time, coffee talk and wine time, that sometimes it's very small shifts in your day that can make a huge difference.
Well, Bridget, it's been great to talk to you. Good luck with the book, and thanks a lot for giving us some of your time out of your busy life. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Bridget Schulte, staff writer at The Washington Post, who covers work-life issues and poverty, author of the book Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play, When No One Has the Time. The conversation's not over. It continues on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. You can post a comment there. Look at what others have had to say about this issue of work-life balance. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.